It's a bad economy. And a guy is on his way to a meeting that will provide him with the only business opportunity that he's had in months and months. And he's desperate to get to this meeting. And it's in Los Angeles, so he can't find a place to park. So he circles the building, and the minutes are ticking away, and he's desperate. And finally, he looks up at the heavens and he says, "Dear God, if you find me a place to park, I'll keep kosher, I'll give money to charity, I'll go to synagogue, I'll listen to the rabbi sermons on the web." And he said it. I didn't make this up. This is what the guy said. And as he's saying this, right in front of the building, someone pulls out. And he looks up and he says, "Never mind, I got it." Now, the underlying theme of that joke is actually what I want to say about why you have such a strange section of the Torah follow last week's Ten Commandments. Because last week, you have the overarching, grand, sweeping appearance of God before Israel, and thunder and lightning and marvels and all of this fantastic pageantry of God's word. And after that, what do you get? If your ox gores someone else's ox, what percentage should you pay of what is lost? And what happens if someone tunnels under and tries to rob your house? And what obligations do you owe, as we read this morning, to the census in the temple? In other words, the minutiae of the law of Judaism. And you think to yourself, really? That's what God had to say for himself after he said, "Thou shalt not murder, and by the way, if your ox happened to gore the other guy's ox, this is what you owe." It's such a come down. It's so much less than we would expect of a revelation at Sinai. At Sinai, you should not reveal the penalty for a goring ox. But if you ask yourself where God dwells, most people will tell you some sort of emotional peak. That is, God dwells in prayer. God dwells in the heart. In fact, there are two dominant metaphors in the Jewish tradition, as Arthur Green points out, for where God dwells. One is the metaphor of the mountain, the upward metaphor, right? God dwells on Sinai. God dwells in the heavens. God dwells up there. And sometimes that transcendent metaphor, the idea that God dwells up there somewhere, is very powerful and comforting. We want to know that God is greater than us. And so we feel that instinctively, what is greater than us? That which transcends us, that which is over and above us. The second metaphor for where God dwells is internal. God dwells in your heart. Every human being is an image of God. In fact, each year, when I teach the class that I'll be teaching shortly after the service is over, when I speak to the religious school or so on, I always ask them, where is God in the sanctuary? And someone will say, well, God's in the Torah. And I'll say, no, actually, that's God's word is in the Torah, right? It's not God, but God's will, God's law. So then they'll say, some of them, well, God's in the Ner Tamid, right? In the eternal light that hangs above the ark. And that's a very good explanation of where God is, because just as you can't see light, but I can see you because there is light, so I can't see God, but I can see things in the world because there is God. But I don't let them get away with that one either. Because the best answer is, if you want to see God, you see God in other human beings, that they're images of God. And that idea that God is transcendent and unseeable, but also immanent inside me, and can relate, those together make up the notion of what we usually think of as the image of God. But here's the problem, and this brings us back to the joke. Last Shabbat was Friday Night Live, and the day following it was Valentine's Day. So I talked about what is and isn't love. And the theme, and again, not to revert to the joke, but it's on the webpage and you're welcome to hear the talk. I won't re-give it, except for a small part. But the theme of it was that love is not an emotion. And the reason that love is not considered an emotion is because emotions are volatile. They change in an instant. That guy who was desperate circling the building, the moment he found a parking space like that, his desperation evaporated. Immediately, and with it, so did his commitment. In one moment, he was ready to commit everything to God, but as soon as he got what he wanted, his feeling changed, and therefore, his commitment turned to dust. How many of us identify with that line that I love quoting from Emerson? My moods don't believe each other. When you're angry, you can't imagine what it's like not to be angry. And when you feel fine, you think, what? Was I crazy? What was I thinking? And if you base love on an emotion, then you're basing it on very unsteady ground. And if someone tells you they love you and they treat you cruelly, then you ask yourself, what does that mean? Love is rather an enacted emotion. Love is feeling expressed in loving behavior. That's what love is, at least in our tradition. So it doesn't matter what you feel, it matters what you do with what you feel. And if someone says, I love you, as they're being cruel to you, you have every right to think they don't. They may think they do, but in fact they don't. What they feel for you may be a strong feeling, but it's not love. Because love expresses itself in loving action. Not 100% of the time, maybe not even 98% of the time, but most of the time, if you love someone, you want what is good for them. And you want its source to be you. So now, let's return to our question and ask it anew. Why is it that after the lightning and the thunder and the declarations and the wonder and the magnificence of Sinai, we are enmeshed in the details of law? And the answer is that that is where God dwells. Not on mountaintops, not even so much in hearts, but in the space between human beings when they act lovingly towards each other. I told you, love expresses itself in lots of different ways. And in that space, there is God. That's what Jewish law means. It says, it's fine to say you should love your neighbor as yourself, as Leviticus does. But if you make that declaration and you act unlovingly, unjustly, cruelly, if you say you should love your neighbor as yourself, but you haven't set up a communal charity to take care of the poor, if you injure your neighbor's property and you never make it right, if you don't respect what is theirs and don't demand that they respect what is yours, if you don't band together for communal activities, and for goodness, that's not love. That's not love. It's entitlement. It's hubris. It's spiritual arrogance, but it's not love. If you think that you don't need law, that your natural love of human beings will just overflow into goodness, then you're terribly naive. Then all you have to do is ask yourself, whether you are more likely to drive according to the speed limit if there's a police car behind you or if there isn't. In other words, does the law matter in your actions or doesn't it? Would you behave differently if our society wasn't constructed around all these laws, or would you not? And the answer is that love requires channels and discipline. Everyone who loves knows this. If you loved me, the beloved always says, you would say good morning. Why? Because part of love is the routinization of caring, is saying good morning every morning, is saying I love you, is using the habits of a lifetime of love so that those habits and love become intertwined and you can't exactly figure out inside yourself where the discipline ends and the feeling begins. Law and love are not separate, they're intertwined. And that's why there is Mishpatim after Yitro. That's why there are laws after Revelation. What is Revelation? Revelation is not just the presence of God, it's the desires of God. And the desires of God are more than individuals. They're also groups and societies. The wish that we would act towards one another in a way that would make us better collectively. There's a story that I've told many times, but actually I want to tell it differently because I understand it differently with this idea, with this notion that love is not just what you experience, but what you exchange, that love is an enacted emotion, that love is what you do with what you have, that love is not a romantic image. You know, in the talk, before I get to the story, I'll just tell you that in the talk that I gave to Friday Night Live, I said, I'm going to talk to you about love, so obviously I'm going to begin with Titanic. Because I remember what I thought when I left that movie. It was the same thing that I thought when I left the movie Ghost, which some of you may remember, right? When you leave Titanic, what are you thinking? I'm thinking, as I watched Leonardo DiCaprio sink below the ocean, I'm thinking, I pity her next boyfriend, right? And I felt the same thing about Ghost as Patrick Swayze goes off to heaven. I thought, who's she going to find that is going to risk his life and die in one of the greatest tragedies that was known until that time so that she might live? And then what came to me next was, not only do I pity her next boyfriend, but I pity everyone sitting in the movie who brought a date. And now they're looking at this guy and thinking, come on. I deserve that, not this. But of course, part of the magic and part of the tragedy of it is you don't see them waking up 20 years later arguing about whether you squeeze the toothpaste from the middle or the end, or whether you sleep with the window open or the window closed. And what I want to suggest to you is that there is more love in figuring out those decisions so that you can live together than there is in a single magical moment of romantic passion that then disappears, that then is over. And then you leave the movie and you're left with an image that love is this great passionate feeling. And if that's not love, then you can't find it. That's why the Jewish marriage contract is a contract. And people say, why is it a contract? And the answer is, because even though passion gives you a running start, sooner or later you have to squeeze the toothpaste. You have to leave the window open or closed. And while nobody wants to live without the first, that is, without the passion, nobody can live without the second. Without a way to negotiate your life so that you can live with someone else in kindness and in love. So here's the story. The seer of Lublin, who was a great Hasidic master, when he was a little boy, the story goes that he used to go off to the woods by himself. And his father who was a kind and tolerant man and so on, wanted to give his child some freedom. But at a certain point, you know, you don't want little kids wandering in the woods by themselves. So he pulls him aside and he says to him, "Listen, I notice that you're going off every day alone into the woods, and I wonder, why do you go there?" And the boy said, "I go there to find God." And his father said, "That's beautiful. But don't you know that God is the same everywhere?" And the boy said, "God is, but I'm not." I want you to know, I've told that story many times, and it always struck me that he goes to the woods to find God. But actually, I think that the presence of God in that story is not in the woods. The presence of God in that story is in the exchange between the child and his father. That's where God is. That's where God's manifest. Now, maybe he had to go to the woods to get to the exchange, but it's in the space between human beings that God lives. Whitehead, the process theologian, said, "Religion is what a man does with his solitude," but I don't believe it. Religion is what we do with each other. That's harder. That takes more of us. It is more difficult to be good to another than it is to feel something alone. It is vaulting out of our loneliness and into love that makes God present in the world. It's reaching beyond ourselves for another through law, through action, through kindness, through goodness. It's seeing, as we said earlier today, a stranger, and by a gesture of openness, ensuring that they don't feel like strangers anymore. That's where God dwells. That's why the Torah is full of law, because it wants to remind us that in the beginning, as the poet Goethe said, was the deed, was doing, was creating something, was drawing another close. That's what we seek in this world. V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, you should love your neighbor as yourself. It means that you should treat your neighbor with love. That we can do. And when we do, even though you may not see anything different, God is present, because the intangible presence of God is in the loving actions of human beings. That is, after all, what Israel learned at Sinai, and what, in our best moments, we have been teaching ever since. Shabbat Shalom.